You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Michael.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Better for seeing you.
Oh, well, thank you, Michael, and it's a pleasure to see you. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are famous author Michael Lewis. You've written such books as Moneyball, most recently The Fifth Risk, bestseller about the Trump administration, The Big Short, made into a movie, like I think Moneyball, right?
Yep.
A lot of bestsellers.
And The Blind Side.
And The Blind Side was also made into a movie?
Yeah.
Congratulations. And I remember Liar's Poker, your first big number one bestseller, because I knew you back then. We were both at the New Republic.
Correct.
And I've been admiring you ever since, but now you've entered a whole new medium. You've started a podcast, called Against the Rules. And it's a produced podcast. It's not like what we're doing here. It's like classy, high production values. It's a narrative. You interview people. It's professional.
We have music.
We have music, Michael. I mean, if you want to get competitive, we have on the audio podcast version, we have a tiny bit of music at the very beginning.
Do you have a harp? We have a harp.
We could get one, okay? If we wanted a harp. Frankly, Michael, we considered a harp and we decided that only cheesy podcasts have them.
All right. Well, the structure of my podcast, unlike the structure of your podcast, is very much the structure of a piece of writing. It's seven episodes and it's a bit like seven long form magazine pieces. So it is different. But this form will tolerate lots of different approaches to it, I think.
Definitely. But, I think yours is a better magnet for ad revenue than mine. but we should say this is one of the very first productions, maybe the first of, Pushkin Industries, founded by.
I think it is the first.
Malcolm Gladwell. And Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah. They've got a few others, teed up behind me, but it actually started. It started at Slate, and we moved it to Pushkin Industries when Jacob Weisberg left Slate and created Pushkin Industries.
Okay. Your podcast has an actual thesis, and it cuts across everything from the judicial system to basketball to media accuracy to fine art auctions, right? And I'm going to talk about that, but first I have to continue this thread and ask you, how does the process of doing a podcast, this is your first one, how does it compare with researching and writing a book?
It's a little different. It's not completely different, but it's a little different. The biggest difference is that researching and writing a book is really very much an individual sport. I do have an editor, and he is important, but the role he plays with me is we talk about the idea before I go and execute the idea. Mm-hmm. And then he will look at the manuscript when I send it in. But the touch is very light. And this thing was, we had, a staff of six or seven people, editors and producers who had a huge effect on how the thing ended up looking.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, a huge effect. I didn't know what I was doing. I'd done a couple of long form radio things for This American Life, which is the closest thing to this I'd done. So one is influence of other people. Two is it's hard to tell the story if you don't have the tape. So just the nuisance of collecting, instead of just going and talking to people and thinking on my own and putting the words down on the page, I had to actually have the recordings of people's voices saying the things they said. So I had to get used to that. The third big difference was just sound. I mean, in the studio, it became clear that there were seven or eight different ways to perform every line. And there were people who were very sensitive to the way the line sounded.
What you mean, you're doing the same line with like different intonations and they're telling you which works?
Yes.
This is serious, man.
Well, when I started, I started by saying, this is Michael Lewis. I'm Michael Lewis and this is Against the Rules. And my editor, Julia Barton, said, are you happy being Michael Lewis? Because you don't sound happy.
Oh, man. Michael. I need a coach like that.
So I was, that's exactly what it was. She was a coach.
Yeah.
And they dramatized for me just how variable performances could be by taking, we have one of the episodes opens with a character reading a passage from the Bible, the Judgment of Solomon passage.
Right, right.
Before we had that character read the passage, we had an actor read it. And the actor read it. It was a paragraph of the Bible. I mean, it was one passage. And he read it 15 different ways. And it really sounded like 15 different things. Wow. So there is, so that was very different to me. Just having to become just a little bit more, just attuned to the sound of my own
voice. You do it well. In the end, after all the coaching, you did it well. You even read the ads well.
Yeah, the ads are a funny subject because I've had a number of friends who really have my best interests at heart.
Who say, don't read ads.
You know, they said to me after the fact, you really shouldn't do that again.
Why not? You're good. You're convincing. I almost sent off for one of those toothbrushes. What's it called? Let me tell you something. In all my time of listening to TrumpCast, I was never tempted to order MeUndies, notwithstanding Jacob Weisberg's tremendous skills as an orator. But you almost had me sold on the electric toothbrush.
Yeah, but there have been two responses to the ads. One was distinguished journalist colleagues, friends saying to me, you really shouldn't be doing that. But the funnier response was, after the first episode came out, my mother calls me. She says, from New Orleans. And she says, Michael, I listened to the podcast, which amazed me because she really hasn't had an iPhone very long. And she doesn't, you know, someone else set it up for her and she doesn't listen to podcasts. Mm-hmm. I said, how did you do that? She said, there was a little icon, the person who set up the phone for me. It said apps you'll never use. So I clicked on that. And inside that, it said podcast. So I clicked on that and there you were. And she said, you know what my favorite part was? And I said, Walker, his grandson is in the first episode. Yeah. I said, she goes, oh, no, okay, my second favorite part. I said, what was your second favorite part? She says, the ads. They were so much better than anything else.
That's kind of a.
She said, you were clearly so enthusiastic about it.
You sound enthusiastic about both. And I would also say that your writing, I don't know to what extent it's been adapted to the medium, but it works very well. There's the crisp, short sentence you're using very well in the podcast.
Have you ever scripted one of your podcasts?
No, I just scripted something that's in production that's more of a video series, but no, not this thing. These are just conversations.
They're just conversations. So when you sit down, I think probably on the extreme end of conversational writers. If some writers are write more or less like they speak, and some writers don't. I'm on the end of writers who write more or less as they speak. People read stuff I write mm-hmm. saying, okay, sounded like you. Mm-hmm. However, the truth is that even when you are a conversational writer, you do not write as you speak. And actually having to script mm-hmm. the thing, it really is a very different process. And you really have to think a little bit about how you sound if you were actually to say this to somebody. The best thing about the whole podcast experience was how different it was. It was just new. It was a new thing. And I really did not know what I was doing in the beginning, but I was in the hands of people who did. And I learned a lot. I mean, it was a gas.
So you're gonna do you think you'll do it again?
I think so.
Yeah.
So this is the other thing that has struck me. The difference in the audience. I would never want to be only a podcaster. I think what I'd like to do is go write a book and then I'll maybe do another season of the podcast. Mm-hmm. The audience for the podcast is one vast. It's just so much bigger than the audience for a book. Already, though it's a brand.
Really? Well, so I guess then you're willing to disclose numbers if they're that big.
We're over 3 million people who've listened to the thing.
And 3 million and, individual people? That's not even total downloads over all episodes?
No. We still haven't aired all episodes.
You've done five.
Right. So they're guessing. So the estimate is after 10 weeks, we're going to have roughly 10 million listens. 10 million. And
okay.
And
that's actual a lot of listens.
Actual listens. So maybe that's, so what is that? 1.5 million people, 2 million people,
yeah,
whatever.
And so the number of downloads would be even higher. Yeah. No, that's okay. You got me beat. All right. You made your damn point.
No, I said my point. No, hold on. So the second thing is the person who's listening is not the same person who's reading my books. The responses I'm getting are from all kinds of people who've never said a word about my books and people who wouldn't naturally pick up a book. There's some overlap, but it's really nice to get to that audience. And the third thing, I don't know if you've noticed this, the medium is a warm medium. Books are a cool medium. When people like your book, they come up and want to have a polite conversation about your book. When they like your podcast, they want to hug you. You know, they feel like they know you.
I don't remember you being a hugger.
Oh, I don't mind it. But people feel a more intimate connection when they're hearing your voice than when they're reading you on the page.
Yeah.
And it's noticeable. Already it's noticeable.
Great. So you're a whole new kind of celebrity. So we should talk about the substance. This has an actual thesis. As I said, how would you characterize the thesis?
I'd say it's pretty simple. It's that we set out to, explore the subject of referees in American life. And if there's an argument that's running through the whole thing, it's that the human referee, if he's actually, a maximizer of fairness, if he's actually not on the take, from one side or the other, is on the run and under assault and being attacked in various ways.
So referees, broadly speaking, including federal judges as well as actual referees and everything in between, broadly speaking, their authority is declining in your view.
Their authority is under assault. Mm-hmm. And you look at sports is the great little laboratory to watch this.
So your first episode is about basketball. I think we should say at the outset that you and I used to play basketball regularly. And I think we should take the opportunity to jointly affirm that we were both pretty good, right?
I thought you were great.
I thought you were great. That's what I meant by jointly affirm that we were good.
But you had a nice mid-range game. you weren't a wimp in the post. You switched out of academic intellectual mode into warrior mode. I thought you were great.
You were too. You're clearly a good athlete. And you were a few years younger than me. I was kind of in the twilight of my career or I would have totally dominated you, but that's life, right?
I felt like you kind of took control of the games. I did.
I'll bet you say that to everybody. So let's talk about the first episode, about basketball. And I mean, one thing that's running through this is that in more than one case, technology has played a role in this, sometimes undermining the authority of the ref. I think in basketball, maybe it's a little more complicated than that, but certainly you start out with the new role that technology is playing in officiating, right?
Yeah, well, it cuts both ways. I mean, the interesting thing about basketball to me is that in the last 3 or 4 years, partly in response to an officiating scandal they had 7 or 8 years ago where a ref was discovered to be gambling on the games, but partly in response to just the sheer amount of grief that referees were taking and the new transparency that the referees were subjected to. I mean, you now can see all the mistakes the ref made in real time in the arena and join in the chant with the crowd, to torment the ref. And the NBA sensed that the refs were going to be more and more exposed to the bad opinions of the rest of us, and they've sought to bust to strengthen them in various ways, with just both on the job training, but also giving them technology to enable them to see the court better and to make more accurate calls. And there's no way that an NBA ref today is anything but more accurate than he was a decade ago. I mean, he's got all these tools he didn't have before.
Including real-time review. You visited the center in Secaucus where these refs are watching the games in real time, and under some circumstances they can intervene and make sure the on-court ref isn't stuck making a bad call, right?
Correct. And they spent a fortune on this place. They spent $15 million bucks to essentially hardwire by fiber optics, this the replay center in Secaucus to every NBA arena. And all it does is watch the angles of the court and their rules about when they can intervene and when they can't, when the refs can go to them and have for help and when they can't. But point is they get more help than they've ever got before on the court. Mm-hmm. And also they've got, after every game, they're walked through all the mistakes they make. So if they have any particular systematic error that they're making, it tends to be beaten out of them. Mm-hmm. But in any case,
yet they catch more grief than ever, right?
The players, are treating them worse than ever. They feel they're more threatened in the arena than they've ever been before. You know, they need bodyguards to and from their cars. That's been true for a little while, but they feel more under assault. And you could see, if you watch the games, if you just watch not only the refereeing, but the way people treat the referees, it's noticeably gotten worse. So the point after the game, that's all the coaches are talking about now, mm-hmm. what the referees did. Right. I mean, I think blaming the ref is a really convenient strategy for everyone involved because it gets the players and the coaches off the hook. The fans get great pleasure at screaming at the ref, so the question is, how is it that the refs are at once unquestionably better than they've been before and unquestionably more reviled than they've ever been? What's going on there? And the first episode just trying to cease to explore that a little bit. And it ends up being kind of a theme we keep coming back to. I mean, that what's going on with NBA refs is also going on with other refs in the society.
Yeah. They are literally demonstrably better. I mean, because there were these studies that found various kinds of deficiencies, including ethnic issues and, you know, biases, and home court favoritism and so on. And in general, those have become less pronounced. The studies.
So that's right. So, if you'd gone and done a study a decade ago about why teams had an advantage on their home court, what you'd have found was that the calls of the refs were a big part of it. Mm-hmm. The refs were favoring the home team, understandably, right? You get hollered at if you're making calls for the visiting team. You get cheered or ignored if you're making calls for them. Mm-hmm. Home court advantage has declined in the NBA, and you can show that the reason it's declined is the refs aren't making that mistake in the same.
Because they're aware of the bias. They're aware of the bias.
That's exactly right. They're aware of the bias, and they were made aware a few years ago through a paper by Justin Wolfers, who's an economist at University of Michigan, of racial bias in their calls. And Wolfers went back after he'd made this first study that had found racial bias in the referees' calls and tried to do another, and he found that the bias had vanished. Mm-hmm. So there are signs that the kind of systematic errors that referees have made are being washed out. And you can see why. They're being held to these objective standards by the people in the NBA. They're held accountable for their mistakes. They don't want to make the mistakes. But the two on the other side, the two things going on. One is that everybody can see the mistakes. But there's also this odd, like, focus on the mistakes. I mean, outside of basketball for a sec, the last NFL season, my New Orleans Saints got beat by the Los Angeles Rams in the game before the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And there was a call by a ref.
Oh, right. What was that call?
He didn't call a pass interference. That it was like one of a billion, but it happened at the end of the game, but it's one of a million things you could have changed about that game and changed the outcome.
Sure.
The first, the coach and the players and the fans, and then the entire city rose up against this referee, so that during the Super Bowl, like, the streets of New Orleans boycotted the Super Bowl, didn't watch the Super Bowl, and marched in the streets against the referee. Everybody knows the referee's name. He's trashed on social media. These kind of things, the amount of attention placed on the referees, focused on the referees, mm-hmm. is, I think, at the same
time. I think sometimes, I mean, maybe I have some kind of false nostalgia for how clear-cut things used to be, but it seems to me in some arenas, they have allowed the lines to blur. And pass interference is a good example. It used to be that basically, if you touched the guy while the ball was in the air, they would throw the flag. Maybe not quite that clear-cut, but much stricter than it is now. Similarly, yeah. You played high school basketball, right? In high school basketball, there was a foul that they used to call reaching in. That just meant you reached around the guy. They didn't even bother to check if you actually made contact with the hand. They would just call it, and that was right. A nice, clear line, right? So you don't reach around. It seems to me that in basketball, what's that?
There's a lot more contact allowed, so all of a sudden it becomes
Yeah, there's more allowed both in basketball and in football than I think used to be the case. And it seems to me that's made life harder on the refs.
I don't know. I don't know whether the refereeing is actually more subjective than it used to be or not. I don't think it is.
One more quick question. You don't think NBA's players get away with traveling more than they used to? I mean,
they don't call traveling in the way that
Okay, you're thank right. you.
You're absolutely thank right about that. You know what they also don't call? They don't call double dribble.
I know.
You notice that if a player dribbles to get control of the ball, if anything happens around him to suggest that maybe an opposing player came close to touching the basketball,
they'll let it go.
He's allowed to dribble again.
Right.
So there are things they let go. But they tend to be things that are kind of trivial to the game. I do think that if you ask me, would I rather be refereed by the officials two decades ago or now? It's just no question. I mean, they used to not even be able to see the game. They're all big and fat, and they all came from the same high school in Philadelphia. It was this old boys club.
They look like weightlifters. I mean, these guys are fit.
They're all fit, and they're just held to standards they weren't held to before. Mm. And even so, people are more upset with them.
Well, basketball is a very hard game to officiate, right? It's harder than calling balls and strikes. A lot of the foul calls are more challenging, balls and strikes, out and safe. You compare it to tennis. Tennis is a game where
they've removed the ref.
Yeah, the technology has actually ended the disputes because the calls are so clear cut that the technology can handle it. You almost never hear a big argument between a player and a linesman anymore.
No, because there aren't any linesmen.
They are not the ultimate court of appeal, right?
Well, you could do the same thing in baseball. You could completely remove the umpire.
Certainly for balls and strikes, yeah.
And line calls, and you could go to tape for, you could go to the videotape for calls at the bases. But there was something that happened in baseball that didn't end up in the first episode of the podcast, but sort of informed the first episode of the podcast. Do you remember when they first started putting those pitch track machines into Major League Baseball stadiums? The thing that shows you the little box with the strike zone.
Yeah, I remember when you first started seeing them on TV. Yeah.
You see the box, and you could see whether the ump got the call right. or not. So now you can just watch. And they could just get rid of that home plate umpire, but because they're wedded to the past and nostalgia, they want to have the guy there. But the umpires, when they put those machines into the ballparks, the umpires were held to the standard of matching the machine. So they come off at the end of the game and they're given a sheet saying you missed six calls. And the way you got better was by aping with the machine. So you no longer had the same kind of discretion. Same kind of thing is happening in basketball.
Right.
And a few years after they started to judge the umpires this way, and the umpires adjusted to the accuracy of the machine, Curt Schilling, remember Curt Schilling, pitcher, he was Red Sox, but I think he was with the Diamondbacks.
And I think it's a big Trump fan, but I digress.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
And this behavior is very Trumpian. Curt Schilling came out of a game early. It hadn't gone well. He grabbed a baseball bat and went and found the pitch track machine and destroyed it because he said it was screwing up the game. And of course, what it was screwing up was Curt Schilling's ability to get calls that he shouldn't get.
Right.
He used to be able to work the ump and 3 inches off the plate was all of a sudden a strike.
Yeah.
And when it wasn't a strike anymore and there wasn't a special strike zone for Curt Schilling, he wasn't as good. He wasn't as effective. And he was angry. What he was angry at was fairness. And I think some of that is what's going on in the NBA. The stars historically have gotten the calls, and the stars are outraged right. when refs actually have to be objective and treat them no differently than some bench warmer. Yeah. That's a lot of the noise right now in the NBA. It's coming, the worst behavior is coming from the stars, and it's the stars not liking fairness. Who likes fairness when you're on top?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's move to the other end of the gravitas spectrum. Your most recently released episode, the series isn't over yet, but it's about judges. And I had been thinking, listening to the early episodes, I hope he's going to get to judges. And you did. And I think this is a case where something different and in some ways alarming is starting to happen, right?
Do you feel that way?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, and part of it is, of course, Trump. Saying, well, this is an Obama judge. I mean, there's a soundbite of him saying that in your podcast. But people are like picking up on it. Just the other day I saw, and I think this was the Wall Street Journal online. It was some highly reputable news source. And I think this wasn't even just in the story. It was in the headline. It was like federal judge, comma, Democratic appointee, comma. Now it used to be that the convention was they did not anywhere in the story allude to whether it was a democratically or republicanly, if that's a word, elected judge, appointed judge, right? And I think there was real merit in that in terms of preserving respect for the judicial system.
Correct. That's right. I think this is absolutely right. And now all of a sudden people are looking for the judge's bias and mm-hmm. assuming in some way or another he's incapable of fairness. And then in some way or another, he's on one side or the other side. In the same way that basketball fans do with refs instinctively, even if they're clearly not. It's a funny emotion. And you can map the behavior towards basketball refs right onto the behavior towards judges. People assume the ref is trying to screw their team. They never assume after the fact the ref did something good for their team or was on their side. It's always negative. And people are looking at judges and saying, oh, he's biased for the other side. And the judge has no counteracting support from the other side. So you see that there's this feeling they're under attack. And Trump, I think here's like with almost everything Trumpian, he's both symptom and cause. He's gotten away with the kind of talk he's gotten away with because the public discourse has been debased sufficiently that he can get away with it. But then he takes us further in that direction. The attacks on the judiciary aren't just coming from the right. They're also coming from the left. You can't be fair because you're a white man. You can't be fair, but you know, that kind of thing. It's unsettling because the whole of our society rests on the independence of the judiciary. Mm-hmm. Once all of a sudden, if you remove the independence of the judiciary, you have a kind of chaos where really just might makes right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm torn because on the one hand, there are patterns of injustice that you want exposed.
Absolutely true. Yes.
But at the same time, for the judges, for the judiciary to have a certain mystique surrounding it is conducive to a kind of respect for the judiciary that has some virtues. Again, the downside is if the respect is not warranted, to whatever extent the respect is not warranted, the upside is you're less likely to have a civil war, right?
Right. That's right. I mean, so the effects on the judiciary are similar to the effects on the NBA refs, that they're forcing the judiciary to actually up its game. I mean, that they're actually very conscious attempts to improve judging. Mm-hmm. There's a school that federal judges now go to called Baby Judge School, where they are introduced to things like the works of Kahneman and Tversky and the idea of cognitive bias.
Right.
To the studies of racial bias. So they're made aware of the kind of mistakes they might make.
Now that's optional, right? You interviewed the person who runs that, but that's optional for judges?
I think they all have to go.
Do they? Federal judges have to go or something?
Yeah, before they sit on the bench. I think they do.
Oh, that's
all have
good.
To go.
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. So the happy story is probably judges are actually going to get better and better at their jobs. That it will be a more professionalized, trained occupation.
Mm-hmm.
But the downside is that we're spending more and more time picking apart their flaws and wondering whether they deserve the authority they have. And there's really no clean alternative to that authority. I mean, you could argue that maybe one day artificial intelligence will solve this problem than every other, all judging will be done by algorithm and people will be happy with machines making these decisions. But it's a long way.
I think we're ways off from that. I think baseball will definitely happen before that happens. Yeah.
Yes, I agree. Right. So, it's funny what environments, tolerate the intrusion of technology to solve the problem.
Yeah.
So tennis, there was never any mystique around the line judge. No one cared who the line judge was. No one knew their names. Every now and then they got hollowed out by John McEnroe. But other than that, you didn't pay much attention.
And they put up with more abuse than referees in other sports.
And they did put up with more abuse than referees in other sports. It was hard to
get kicked out. Then. Yeah.
Hard to get kicked out because they didn't have a match then. Nobody minded when they just, plus they're in the way, right? Like you'd rather not have them on the court physically. So that was a really easy space to put that Hawkeye system into and just get rid of them all together. Baseball is a harder space because people are actually wedded to the presence of these characters. They like the fact they're human beings. They're making mistakes every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And judge on the bench is a much, much, much harder problem. I mean, it'll be a long time, I think, before anybody's prepared to accept the ruling from a machine.
A point you make is that there are arenas in which ostensibly impartial judges are, in fact, basically paid by parties who have an interest in the outcome. And that includes like bond ratings and art, the evaluation of the authenticity of paintings. The story you tell about that supposed Leonardo da Vinci painting is kind of amazing. I mean, tell me, did I get the subtext right that you would think that the smart bet is against it being a legitimate Leonardo?
Absolutely.
And yet somebody paid. How much did the guy pay?
$450 million.
Match.
Yeah. Saudi prince paid $450 million for it. For a painting that it spent, I think, 30 years of its life down the street from me in New Orleans. And the owner had paid, $50 for it to get it out of a English auction in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
A painting that had most of the original paint was gone. There was zero concrete evidence that it was painted by Leonardo or even that Leonardo had painted such a subject. And it was so heavily repainted by the restorers once it had been fetched out of this New Orleans house that made to look a lot more like a Leonardo than it had ever looked. And then it gets kind of massaged by the referees in the art world to the point where all of a sudden it's maybe a Leonardo, then it's a Leonardo, then it's the last Leonardo, the only Leonardo that's still out there. But the bigger point was, it was just an illustration of the bigger point that when you look around the world of referees and you ask which ones are happy right now, who's doing real well as a ref, making a lot of money, their stature, their status is still intact. They're living comfortable lives. Nobody's really hollering at them. It's always referees who've been bought by one side or the other.
Right.
So the credit rating agencies are another great example. They're paid by the Wall Street firms to assign a rating to the bonds that the Wall Street firms create. The art experts who are hauled in to determine whether this is a Leonardo or not are all one way or another incentivized by the person who has the picture to say, yes, it's a Leonardo. No one does well if you say no, it's a Leonardo. Mm-hmm. If you say yes, it's a Leonardo, you created $450 million out of thin air. Another example is these characters called CEO pay consultants. They are referees of CEO pay who did not exist back when CEO pay was more or less reasonable. go back to the 70s when the average CEO was paid, what, 20 times his the average employee's pay. CEO pay, there were no CEO pay consultants. That referee gets created only to rubber stamp the more outrageous pay packages of CEOs. So that the happy ref is the ref who's, and it's the ref who's got actual, an actual source of support. Mm-hmm. It, the person who's paying him. So that episode is about that. It's about like, why would referees be happy right now? Or how are they, where are they comfortable? They're comfortable in places where they've got a sponsor. Mm-hmm. It's where they have no sponsor, where they're actually sitting in the middle trying to do their job fairly, where they're being screamed at and made miserable.
Right. And I remember in the movie, The Big Short, based on your book, there was a scene where the guy was talking to a bond raider. She was either at Standard & Poor's or Moody's, and she kind of admits, like, hey, they're paying us, as I recall, right? I mean, it becomes clear that the system is corrupt. I assumed, actually, that was an idealization, and that scene's not actually in your book, per se, although the point is made in your book, but in any event.
No, the scene's in the book.
The scene itself is in the book, because it was such good drama. You know, I thought, right? I mean, it worked so well in Hollywood, I thought, well, they probably made that part up, but no.
So that was almost verbatim from the book.
Really?
And what she said, the one of the people who was the Steve Carell character, who was trying to figure out how the subprime mortgage market worked and couldn't understand why Moody's and Standard & Poor's were rating AAA, big piles of really trashy loans, went in to go see, I think it was Standard & Poor's, because he knew somebody there. Mm-hmm. They were going to explain to him why this all made sense. And he asks her, what do you make of the actual loans? Do they give you the records of the actual loans? And she says, no, we never see those. He said, well, how can you make the judgment? He says, well, we have to make the judgment, because if we didn't make the judgment, they'd just go to Moody's and pay Moody's for the rating. So they were acknowledging that the people they were reffing essentially controlled what they were able to see before they rendered their judgment. Yeah. And it's not that different from the art world, and it's not that different from the CEO pay world. So I think there's a broader point of the series is, if you see a referee who's being screamed at and who everybody's angry with,
it's probably somebody actually trying to do a good job.
His job. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You should stop and say, why is everybody angry? Everybody's angry because he's trying to be fair.
Yeah.
He might make mistakes. Nobody says that the NBA refs don't make mistakes, but they're kind of doing as good a job as a person can do. Mm-hmm. It's not like you can haul someone out of the stands and they're going to do a better job. Let me ask you this. This all starts for me. I got interested in this subject as a subject, both watching my kids' sports games and watching professional sports. I couldn't believe that entire arenas of American citizens would scream, ref, you suck, ref. That bothered me so much but also watching my kids' sports games, everybody's always upset. There's no game after which the loser is not upset with the ref.
Yeah.
And it doesn't exist. And there's all the ref always comes up as the problem. And the winner on the other hand forgets the ref ever did anything.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of got me interested in this. It's just people are really unaware of how they respond of their own biases that they bring.
Oh yeah, I think we're designed by natural selection to be unaware of our own biases and to have the biases. I mean, you know, there's all these studies, some of which I think you probably allude to in the judges one. Oh yeah, it's something like the average judge, like 81% of judges or something say that they are less likely than the average judge to be reversed on appeal or something, which of course can't be the case. I mean,
90% say they're less likely to be racially biased.
Right. But this goes across, you know, you ask people in general, are they more moral than average? Are they more this than average? Especially in the realm, in the moral realm, people hugely overestimate how they stand relative to the population at large. And I think that's by design. It makes us argue strongly for our interests, and you're more likely to win an argument if you're convinced that you're in the right.
That's right. I think that's right. So that's what's going on.
Yeah. So anyway. By the way, speaking of your son, is he named after Walker Percy?
Walker Percy and Walker Evans.
My wife, that was going to be my second guess.
Is a photographer, and we just like the name.
Okay. It's a good name. So now, one interesting thing about the series is I started off thinking it might have a conservative kind of vibe overall, some kind of longing for the restoration of authority, you know, that sounds kind of right wing, but it turns out to depend on how it's applied. I mean, in the financial realm, you get into, you know, you kind of, I mean, Elizabeth Warren becomes the hero because she thinks there should be more kind of government refereeing of the financial services sector. Well, right?
You know, the finance, and I agree with her. I mean, I think
that's clear.
Yeah, no, it's, I was spoiled for choice on Wall Street, for referees that weren't doing their jobs. And we ended up, you know, we ended up because I didn't want to do the same show over and over, picking one, and the one was the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, created by Elizabeth Warren. But it's a story of how in a space that so clearly is crying out for a referee, the space between sophisticated financial companies and ordinary Americans, and those interactions are ridiculously unfair often for the ordinary Americans. And there really needs to be the equivalent of a consumer products referee for the consumer finance. And we created this thing, which made great good sense and seemed to be doing a very good job. But all it took was 5 or 6 years before an administration comes in that proposes to gut it, and no one seems to care. So I guess that's a liberal left-wing message. I'm not sure why it should be, but I guess that counts as a liberal message. I don't think there's a particular party political point of view for this whole thing.
No.
There are places where conservative leaning people would be advocating for referees, and there are places in the society where liberal leaning people will be advocating for referees. So the referees of language, you know, usage experts.
And we should say you were once one, right? You were on the American Heritage Dictionary's, what is it, the panel of usage or something?
The usage panel.
Right.
You must have been on that. You weren't on that too?
No, of course not. No, I'm no you. I'm no you.
That's you do false modesty.
Who appointed you? Who appointed you, Steve Pinker?
I didn't know, but apparently yes.
Okay. Well, ask him why I was never on it.
He's a friend of yours, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, until I found out about this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but it's okay because they fired us all. So this is not, you're not missing out on anything anymore. Mm. But I would think that the conservative mind is drawn to the idea of people imposing standards on the use of the language. And the liberal mind thinks, well, you know, that's unnecessary and B, probably in various ways unfair to people who don't speak the language in a conventional way. So it's all over the place. Politically, it's all over the place. I wasn't thinking this is a political story.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of it more like, oh, yeah, look at all these odd things that are going on in American life.
Yeah.
And there's a pretty clean argument running through it. What I didn't know whether, and I still don't know, it'll be interesting to see when the whole thing's done, if it sounds like a single story, or if it sounds like seven kind of only sort of related stories. The goal was to, at the end, have the listener feel like they basically listened to a book.
Yeah.
But a book in seven episodes.
I can see it as a book.
I don't know if that's how it's being received.
No, it's coherent. And you're very good at creating suspense and so on and tying things together. You know, sometimes seemingly disparate things. I mean, the episode on but it makes sense in the end. The episode on usage, language usage police, also includes media police. You know, and the fascinating story of this guy who, this Russian guy. I mean, I remember when the story broke about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. One reason it was so, and look, Cambridge Analytica, I'm sure deserves all the disdain we pour on it. But still, one reason that the whole story sounded so shady is there was this Russian, like, professor, and he was their gateway to Facebook's data. It turns out this guy's totally legit. He does not have a Russian accent. He studied under somebody you and I both know, Dacher Keltner at Berkeley, and he's actually a psychologist with an earnest interest in using the unique data set that Facebook has to offer.
Who happens to have been born in the Soviet Union, yeah, but moved here when he was 6 years old. He was basically a Brooklyn kid.
Right.
But the story people were prepared to believe after Trump won was that there was some diabolical force behind him. And they were prepared to believe that there was this evil genius, Cambridge Analytica political consultancy, who somehow had used data and Facebook to get Trump elected. Mm-hmm. If you just start poking and prodding that story, Cambridge Analytica had worked for Ted Cruz before they worked for Trump.
Right.
And that was, if they were that diabolically clever, they certainly didn't show it there. But second, the stuff they were doing was of very clearly in the eyes of the people they were asking to do it of no particular value. They couldn't predict people's personalities based on their Facebook data. And that was the project. So I think it's far more common with these political consultants generally. The con isn't that they're tricking the American voter into voting for some candidate. The con is they're tricking some politician into paying for their services.
Right. Right.
And that they actually don't know very much. And they're not very helpful.
Now, this is always been one of your virtues as a writer. I can tell you take genuine delight in the absurdity of that, right? I mean, your absurdism has been a big asset for you, don't you think? Your sense of the absurd, your appreciation of the ridiculous.
I guess it can't hurt. But in this case, how can you miss it? I mean, how can you miss it? The idea that the Trump campaign was organized enough to actually go and do something diabolically clever with voter data, I don't even believe that. Even the idea that there was any use to the Russians of Trump's colluding with them. I don't even know what they would have done to help. If I were a Russian trying to screw up the American election, I would think going into the last Trump election, I would have thought the best strategy was Donald Trump to stay away from me because you're not going to help me in any way. I have, I can pollute the environment without your help. Mm-hmm. And there's no particular point in colluding. But leaving that to one side, this narrow story, the Cambridge Analytica story, it ends up on the front page of the New York Times and the Guardian. And all of a sudden, this kid who is a psychology student of a friend of ours, who's a kid from Brooklyn, who is just like doing a project that even he thinks is stupid, is tagged as a Russian spy, right, who swung the election to Donald Trump.
Right. The story was kind of legit, but his role, I remember how darkly he was cast.
Yeah. And you sit down, it takes about 10 minutes after you sit down with him to realize he knows nothing.
Yeah.
He and his tools of no conceivable use to any presidential candidate. And he was aware of it, mm-hmm, and was willing to freely admit it to Cambridge Analytica, but Cambridge Analytica didn't want to admit it to the Trump campaign because the Trump campaign was paying them money for, right, those tools.
Yeah, so that's a case where actually ideologically this story works both ways, because what you're saying resonates on both the right, the pro-Trump side, and kind of the far left, kind of the Glenn Greenwald left.
Yes.
But so that you tell that story in the context of the demise of like ombudsman media people, because the New York Times used to have this really excellent kind of ombuds person or whatever, Margaret Sullivan. She did her 1 year term. I don't really think her successor was better, as good as her, but in any event, her successor was the final one, and the Times discontinued them, and you seem to kind of lament the demise in general of people whose job it is to criticize, well, the ombudsman in particular.
The news ref. Yes, the news ref. But and it isn't that I'm not entirely sure that they had a very strong ombudsperson, that story still wouldn't have gotten right. out there. Although I do think, especially in the national political reporting, having that person on your shoulder as a journalist does give you pause because it's just one more voice in your head saying, is this really true or is this just feeding the readers the red meat they want? But I do think that the bigger story is that we have a big problem with unrefereed news space. And there's a need not just for those ombudsmen, but new kinds of ombudspeople. Facebook should be engaged in a project of news refereeing where,
well, there are these fact checking sites, but they are, each one is thought of as having an ideological character and they probably do in some sense. I don't know.
And the problem is nobody will trust any referee.
Right. Exactly. Right. Because,
people will choose the news they want.
Now, the counter argument is that more than ever, this kind of thing can get crowdsourced. All these stories are subjected to more in the way of, amateur criticism, which is true. And you can see it online. And so, and I think it's certainly true that it was easier in some sense to bury certain kinds of errors you would make as a journalist 40 years ago. Like somebody write in a letter to the editor and the magazine just wouldn't publish it. And that would be it, you know?
Right, right.
But
Stephen Glass would not have lasted as long as
yes. he did. Oh, you're bringing back the memory. So Stephen Glass was this so infamous that they made a movie about him. Did you? He was at the New Republic. It turned out he was just fabricating stuff. I knew him slightly. Did you overlap with him?
So I wrote a series for the New Republic about the 96 presidential campaign. You were still there then, right?
Yeah, the book that your editor would not allow you to call Losers.
Correct. And Stephen Glass was my fact checker.
Oh, congratulations on that.
That's not a bad
now,
title.
Now, I know I can already anticipate the irony. He was probably a good one, right?
Yes. He was a good one.
Yep.
And he was he was one of the interns at the New Republic who was fact checking the stories as they came in. So yeah, and I was fond.
It was when he was the byline that he wanted to make the stuff up.
That's right. But it would be much harder to get away with that kind of thing for very long now. I think that's right. But there's another kind of thing, and it's sort of a sense checker that, if you feed an existing bias, you will find support on one side or the other. And it doesn't matter that the other side, the anger of the other side or even the attempts to debunk you of the other side just fall on deaf ears.
Oh, it's worse than that. They validate from the point of view of the one tribe. I mean, we're seeing this today in Trump's America, right? I mean, with in this polarized America, the anger of the other side only strengthens your conviction that you were right in the first place.
That's right. Right.
So.
Anyway, did you like the podcast?
Oh yeah, it's great. I'm waiting. I'm on the edge of my seat. I think there've been five, not counting the
judges was six. Number six. Today was number six.
And so there's going to be how many more?
There's one more of the series, and then we just did a little bonus episode, which is me and Malcolm Gladwell talking together about it. But there's seven episodes of the series.
Yeah, it's great.
And it's been interesting enough that I really think I might do another season.
I think you should.
But you don't think there's an argument you shouldn't get away from the book writing because that's serious and the podcasting isn't?
Well, I think, you know, one thing you could do is do a podcast as an exploratory, journey into an area that you might wind up writing a book about.
Yeah. Use it as R&D.
Yeah, sure. And then you've got the transcripts and 80% of which hasn't seen the light of day.
Right. That's the funny thing. You know, I haven't thought much about that, but because I was an amateur at this, I over-interviewed. I did so much more interviewing than I needed to do. And I have these fabulous interviews that just didn't fit in anywhere.
There you go.
And I don't know what to do with them. Some of them really deserve to see the light of day, but I don't know quite what form to do that with. But it's,
you could probably put some of them on audio. And if your initial audience is this big, you could get a respectable audience listening to some of the less refined versions of this, probably. I don't know.
Do you find the response to you in this form is different from the response to you in print?
Oh, gosh. I mean, well, the only time anybody ever walks up to me and say, which doesn't happen often, but says, remind me of your name or whatever they say, it's when they've seen me on this. But as the years have gone by, this is more and more an audio audience and less and less a video one. There was a time when it was all video and it was, you know, that part was, you know, so, I don't know. That's a good question. The truth, look, I don't have your level of celebrity. I don't get all that often run into people who give a damn about me one way or the other.
Oh, stop.
I don't.
Presidents read your books.
What? Bill Clinton did read that book. Yes. And he talked about it. God bless him. So, now I know you got to take Walker. Is it that his softball team? You're the bus driver. Is that it?
So I'm the bus driver for Dixie. Dixie's a junior in high school and we're in the playoffs and we got a playoff game in 45 minutes.
Is Dixie a daughter?
Dixie's a daughter.
Uh huh.
Softball's a girl sport. So Dixie's a daughter and she'll play in college.
Really?
Yeah, she's good.
Oh, you mean after you bribe the softball coach?
So don't even joke about that. They're interested in her. There are plenty of coaches that are really interested in her. And she's got this wonderful team, the Berkeley High School softball team, where we're going off to play Castro Valley in the semifinals of the league championship.
Okay.
So I do have to go.
I was joking about that. Of course, that's been in the news that some parents, less scrupulous than you, needless to say, have actually bribed college coaches. So that was just a reference to that, not meant to impugn your integrity.
Another refereeing problem, right?
Another refereeing problem.
And it's going around the referee. It was a way around the college admissions process.
Yep.
And you've been through the process. It is amazing. The power that coaches have been given in that process. It's bizarre. I mean, you could kind of maybe sort of understand why a big revenue generating sport like SEC football might give the coach power to figure out who he wanted at the school.
But why the water polo?
Sailing? Stanford sailing? I mean, it's incredible that the Stanford sailing coach is allowed to give the Stanford admissions office any kind of list. Why not the history professor? It's a very odd thing. And I'm worried. I just want to make sure that the system doesn't change for 2 years because Dixie's going to be going through this process in the next 18 months. But after that, I'm going to argue vociferously that the coaches.
Well, I will not editorialize it against it in the meanwhile.
Thank you.
No problem. Thanks for taking the time, Michael. This has been a great conversation. Great podcast, Against the Rules. Never too late to start listening to it.
Don't be a stranger if you come out here.
Okay. Same with you. You know where I live. I think anyway, if you don't, I'll tell you.
All right.
See you around.
Bye bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.